Welcome to the Birthful Podcast. I'm Adriana Lozada, and today we'll be talking about newborn sugar level concerns and breastfeeding. There are certain conditions where a newborn's risk of hypoglycemia increases. What are those conditions? How and when are they tested for? If there's a concern, does that mean your baby needs formula supplementation? And how does all of this impact initial breastfeeding? Dr. Casey Rosencarroll has answers. Stay tuned. This episode of Birthful is brought to you by Vistaprint, helping you own the now in any situation. Get 500 high-quality custom business cards starting at $9.99 when you go to vistaprint.com/birthful. This episode of Birthful is also brought to you by BetterHelp, the world's largest e-counseling platform, making professional counseling accessible, affordable, and convenient so you can get help anytime, anywhere. Go to betterhelp.com/birthful to get 10% off your first month. The Birthful Podcast, talking to maternity pros and new parents to inform your intuition. Hello, mighty parents and parents-to-be. As always, thank you for all the love you give this show and your ratings and your reviews and your requests and your general support. If what you hear is helpful, make sure you subscribe so you don't miss a thing. You can support this podcast by supporting its sponsors, which in this week's case are Vistaprint and BetterHelp, and also by becoming an official Birthful patron at patreon.com/birthful. And as a thank you, patrons get access to extra content for each episode, as well as access to ad-free episodes. So go check it out at patreon.com/birthful. Also, a quick reminder that if you've only prepared for the having a birth part, then you're kind of halfway there. You need to prepare for the having a baby part. Get prepared by taking my Thrive with Your Newborn online postpartum preparation classes at birthfulcourses.com. And you can do them in your pajamas and re-watch them after the baby is born, or as a refresher for your second baby as many times as you want. Do it at your own pace, faster, quicker. They're intended to be 5 weeks, but you can do them at the pace that works for you. You get access to everything immediately, though. You do want to take them before your baby arrives. So go sign up now at birthfulcourses.com. All right. So my guest today is Dr. Casey Rosencarroll, who is Medical Director of Lactation Services and Programs at the University of Rochester, where she practices outpatient and inpatient breastfeeding medicine. And her research focus is in systems change for breastfeeding education and support. So I cannot think of anyone better suited to help us understand all these ins and outs and intricacies of what the concern and protocols for addressing the risk of newborn hypoglycemia are all about, and the impact that this has on breastfeeding initiation. So I am super happy and excited to have her here today. Let's get started. Welcome, Casey. It is so, so lovely. Such an honor to have you here today.
Oh my gosh, I am so excited. I've heard about your podcast since I moved here, and I'm just excited to be on it. So thank you for including me.
Yeah, and we have the fortune of being in the same city. So we get to connect not just on the podcast, but out in the field, in the hospitals and such.
And referring to each other, which is great.
Yeah, yeah. So I was definitely excited to be able, because you're so knowledgeable and you do such amazing research, that having you on the show is a treat for sure.
Oh, thank you.
And I did give a bit of intro before we started talking about what you do, but why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I was trained as a pediatrician, and then I transitioned a few years back into just doing full-time breastfeeding medicine, and I'm so blessed to be able to have made that a career. So I work in the outpatient setting, so I see patients in clinic with a group of awesome lactation consultants, and I also round in the hospital most of the time in our NICU or our birth center. But also on the cardiac floors or in the pediatric floors or occasionally in the ER if they need us. And sometimes people wonder, what is breastfeeding medicine, right? Most people have heard of lactation consultants. But we kind of think of breastfeeding medicine as just the medical side of the lactation consultant work. So lactation consultants do a lot of latch and positioning and timing and back to work and awesome counseling. And whereas breastfeeding medicine providers tend to focus more on issues, medical issues like medications or how certain illnesses like rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis might interact with breastfeeding. We also do a lot of work with kids with septic dysfunction and tongue tie. And then in the hospital, I spend a lot of time trying to figure out how our policies are working or not working for parents in terms of helping people to breastfeed. And I do research in breastfeeding as well.
Mm-hmm. Lots of places, lots of things. And it is, I know that in the past we've talked about how almost it was ridiculous that it took so long for breastfeeding medicine to even be a thing.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, Dr. Ruth Lawrence, who was sort of the grandmother of the field, she helped to establish the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine and the U.S. Breastfeeding Committee, and really tried to turn this into more of a mainstream thing. And I'm following in her footsteps, and I'm so lucky. But it still needs to be more institutionalized. And I don't mean that in a way that will, you know, kind of decrease or mainstream its worth, but more to get more people to recognize that this is something that we do and that there's more that we can do if people are having trouble breastfeeding, rather than just handing somebody a bottle. And we can have better outcomes, both for breastfeeding, but also for how these parents think about it and feel about it. I mean, they're trying so hard and they need more help.
Exactly. Yeah. Trying so hard. And I think that's the insight that I appreciate of how you come towards your approach towards creating protocol or establishing, you know, the considering both the parents and the hospital needs and how can that be supportive for everybody involved. And I think that was a piece that was missing.
Yeah, I mean, and I saw it in my own care with my own babies, and I saw it as a pediatrician. And so I just really appreciate being able to be part of the solution. I think we need to work as hard as the parents are working at these things. And we can't just leave it all up to people. Say, you know, breastfeeding is really great. Now go do it, you know? And I think that's how a lot of people end up feeling about it.
Mm, yeah. So we're going to go down a little bit of a rabbit hole today because we're going to go, we're going to take all that breastfeeding support and knowledge and then go specifically looking at sugar levels and hypoglycemia because this tends to be a point of concern for providers that a lot of parents don't even know about or is on their radar. And I find that that can be a really disconnect in those first few hours of within the first few minutes of a baby's life of, hey, we have to do these tests or we have to check for the, you know, sugar level. So that's our broad talk for today. Let's back up. Why do we even care about sugar levels?
Yeah, I think it's great. And this is a great thing to talk about because I love your perspective as a doula coming in that way, saying like, wow, you just gave birth to a brand new life and now I'm going to start poking it, you know, and that feels really bad. So caring about sugar levels, what I'd like everybody to picture is you can think of a strawberry shortcake doll or like an anime character, like basically a bobblehead character that has like a giant head and a teeny tiny body. And those images are so cute because they're based off of the newborn infant that has a really much bigger head than it does to body size, right? And I bet you talk about this in other podcasts, talking about where that head goes as it's coming out. But in this case, we're really talking about it in that the head makes up a large part of the body and it's full of brain. And brain doesn't have its own energy source. It doesn't have its own glucose. And so that's a large percentage of the body that can't really take care of itself, unlike the other tissues of the body that have muscle around and fat around and so forth, or even, you know, different forms of glucose. And so what happens, the reason we care about sugar levels is because newborns have a really high need for glucose. It's like 2 to 3 times higher the rate that an older child or an adult will need. And so it takes a lot of feeding to meet that rate. And if that rate falls off, then the first organ you can imagine that it impacts is the brain, right? And so in severe cases, that has led to neurodevelopmental issues or even hypoglycemic, so low sugar level seizures, coma. And unfortunately, some babies haven't made it because of hypoglycemia.
And so the risk is the possibilities, right? It's very scary if something happens, but the actual risk of that developing, what are we talking about?
Yeah, so one of the problems with this whole field is that we're really not quite sure what is normal, and testing the boundaries of what is normal is kind of complicated, right? Because anytime you try to test the boundaries, that means you incur a certain risk. And if you incur that risk for something like a seizure or a coma, that's a really bad idea. So at least we know that about 10% of babies, of like healthy term babies, will have what we call transient hypoglycemia. Means that right after birth, and I think we're going to talk about some of these mechanisms later, but right after birth, the blood sugar could go down. And then because you go skin to skin and then you breastfeed right away, it should come right back up again. We really don't have good numbers for how often it results in it going down or staying down. So the severe and persistent hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, we don't have great numbers for how often that happens and results in seizures or coma or mortality. There are some figures that look like they'll, and the evidence is a little bit conflicting here, but there are some figures that will say things like in one preterm population, the babies with hypoglycemia had a 3.5 times higher risk of developmental delay 4 years later, right? Which, is a lot for a preterm population to go up. Other studies will say 30% of babies with low blood sugar had lower scores on developmental testing. But again, those studies were done in preterms, and they're not always, I mean, you can't easily translate that to the healthy term newborn who's going to be right on, his mom's chest and start nursing right away.
And you also, I guess it would be hard to say specifically that this is called because of the sugar levels and not something else
Exactly.
about being premature.
Right. And so, we do things in statistics to try to account for that. You try to compare as close as you can, apples to apples, preterms to preterms, and you can control for race and socioeconomics. But even then, any study is really trying to get as close as you can to truth, but isn't truth, and you need to be able to interpret it.
And so, and you said that about 10% of healthy term babies have what is called this transient hypoglycemia, which I did find in the literature that it seems to be normal for a baby's blood sugars to go down a bit on that first hour and then come up on their own, regardless of what you do. Is this something that, for all this process, does the body not have a protective mechanism to help out? Do we
Right.
know about it?
Right. Or even is it useful for some reason that we don't fully understand, right? Like the kids with jaundice that don't end up getting treated, but just have some jaundice, right? Is there a survival benefit that we just don't understand yet? So there's really three ways that the little baby ones can come out and this will and make sugar. And this will help us later understand why some babies are more at risk for this than others. One is that your liver has what's called glycogen in it, glycogen stores that can be broken down to make sugar, to make glucose, right? The second is that muscle can be broken down to make ketones. People tend to know a little bit more about ketones because, like, if you run a race, then you could have ketones, or like a diabetic, right, can have ketones. And then the third way is that your fats should be breaking down, and you can get some free fatty acids, and you can make glucose and ketones and other fuels in that way. And so when you come out as a baby, your liver's not that big. Your glycogen stores, you haven't really needed to rely on your liver for this because you've been relying on mommy and the placenta or the parent. And, you know, you don't have a lot of musculature and you don't have a whole lot of fat to burn, right? And so it's, you know, your whole body is transitioning from being dependent on your birth parent to all of a sudden being dependent on these other mechanisms. And it can take maybe an hour or two for those to kick in. For most healthy term babies who aren't going to end up with low blood sugar. And this forms the basis of like, why are we only measuring blood sugars routinely in babies who are at higher risk?
Right. And since we're talking about those things, can you also speak about brown fat?
Yeah. And, you know, I think brown fat is like really, I mean, it's amazing stuff. If you think about brown fat and you're trying to, if it's the first time you've heard of the words, think about bears, bears and babies, brown, right? Because it's super insulating and it's metabolically active, right? As opposed to being like much harder to break into, like, you know, mind fat stores as an over 40-year-old woman. And so that is one of those innate mechanisms by which babies can start recovering more quickly after birth.
And I just recently found about brown fat and I was fascinated. I was like, ah, it's okay if the milk's not
Yeah.
completely there or this instant.
Right.
You got a little bit of something there to balance, shore you up, balance you in case, give you so that it all is not lost, right? Yeah.
I love that. And that's a beautiful way of saying it, right? Some of these things are, you know, the best survival is with everything working as it should, right? Without us getting in the way. And in fact, in this topic, one of the concerns is overtreatment for something that should be considered normal.
Right. And coming from the angle of birth, you know, I find that within the birthing process, there's so many little mechanisms of that when you find out, it's like, oh, nature's got it. Because if we weren't here, like if we were out in the wild, there something needed to happen. This, you know, like this situation could arise in the wild and nature's got it. So,
Right. Yeah, right. And
right.
that should be reassuring for people, right? That more often than not, what hospitals are trying to do these days is get back to the way it's been done, you know, with the exception of the past century.
Right.
Yeah.
So in terms of hypoglycemia, are there any specific signs or symptoms that show that it is happening?
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is where we get into like how do we draw the line between making sure that people are going to have the best experience, the most physiologic, like normal anatomy kind of experience, and then paying lots of close attention to when things aren't going well so that we prevent anything that we can, right? That could be really damaging for newborns. So when we think about signs and symptoms that show it, the problem with the signs and symptoms for hypoglycemia is that they're really nonspecific. So, you know, I think even, you know, parents that have like other kids, you can still have kind of a hard time reading your baby's cues, right? And when babies get sick, they don't act like older kids who get sick. And so the types of signs and symptoms we're looking for can also look like other things, like infection or birth trauma. But broadly speaking, they can be classified into two different categories. One is called neurogenic, which is also adrenergic. And those both basically mean genic means like coming from. So one would be like coming from neuro, so kind of the brain neurologic system, adrenergic, right? And then the other is neuroglycopenic, which basically means neuro, which is neurology, brain system. Glyco means sugar, and penic means low. So in that first category, which is really the adrenergic category, if you think about adrenergic, you're thinking about adrenaline, right? So it's that fight or flight type stuff. So how are you feeling when you're feeling like your adrenaline is up? You might be jittery, you might have a high-pitched cry if you're a baby. You might be hard to settle, you might have a hard time feeding. And tachypnea too, so breathing fast is a common neurogenic sign. or adrenergic, same thing, sign of low blood sugar. And then the other, which is the low blood sugar affecting the neurologic system, would be like babies who are just not getting enough to their brain, and they start settling out into not breathing as much and being kind of floppy and being poor feeders at the breast and being sleepy. And in my experience, we see that a lot more with hypoglycemia. So, you know, it might be that those are the earlier signs, but we do see both.
Mm-hmm. And they're like extreme, like polar opposites almost. Like one's yeah. super jittery and the other one's more lethargic.
Right. And you would think that it would have something to do with a continuum, but we really just don't have good enough data for that at this time. And so it might be more about, you know, something innate about that baby or the birth process. As well, births are so complex these days, mm-hmm. as you know, and so, you know, it's possible that we just haven't teased that all out yet.
Mm. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's get into, you know, how this testing is done and who is more at risk and for getting, or who has more of an indication of needing to be tested. We'll be right back. When I started offering doula services a gazillion years ago, one of the first things that made me feel like I was doing this for real and was all in was when I had professional business cards done. And truth is, 12 years ago, I had them done from Vistaprint. So many times I've been glad to have those cards at hand, ready to hand out and make that professional first impression. Those moments of opportunity happen all the time because you never know who you're going to meet at a local birth networking event or at your child's school or even at the playground, just out and about in your day. Your next big opportunity is coming right now, and all it takes to feel like you're ready to own the now with professional business cards is $10. Yes, $10. That's a really low price to get seen in a new way. A custom card with the colors, fonts, designs, and images you choose means that you can look and feel like a big deal whether you're starting up or have been doing this for a while. And it doesn't have to be hard. With Vistaprint, you can create a truly professional, unique card in minutes. The process goes like this. First, you upload your own design or start with one of Vistaprint's professionally designed options. They offer simple tools and a wide range of templates for you to choose from. Then you pick the paper stock, style, and quantity that's right for you. And by the way, Vistaprint uses only carefully selected inks and responsibly sourced paper stocks. Then you choose your delivery speed, place your order, and receive your cards in as few as 3 days. And your satisfaction is 100% guaranteed, or they'll make it right, either by reprinting your order or offering a refund. Vistaprint wants you to be able to own the now in any situation, which is why our listeners will get 500 high-quality custom business cards starting at $9.99. Just go to vistaprint.com/birthful. That's vistaprint.com/birthful. vistaprint.com/birthful. And we are back talking with Dr. Casey Rosen-Carroll about sugar levels and newborns and breastfeeding and all that good stuff. So in terms of the screening itself, and to check those sugar levels, is it something that every baby needs to have done? And how is that screening done? Or do we have certain kids that are like, you're more at risk, let's check you?
Yeah. And so it's definitely the latter. And the reason why is because as we start talking numbers, you'll see that we really just don't have a consensus yet about which numbers are important. And the reason why is because there hasn't been one number that we found for sure will indicate how a baby is going to do clinically. So you could have a baby with a blood sugar of 30, and you could have another baby B, with a blood sugar of 30, and one can be doing fine and the other could be having a seizure. So what we try to do is we try to really target the things that have gone along with the poor outcomes in the studies, right? So instead of saying, like, it's clear that we're not sure that the number is everything. And so what we're going to do is we're really going to look at, okay, what are the things that go with numbers that should make us worried about how those numbers are going to impact them? Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So one of the things is late preterm, right? So these are the babies who are born like 34 to just before 37 weeks. They're a little bit early. That means that their liver's not working quite as hard. Remember, we talked about that. They don't have as much muscle. They don't have the brown fats as much, right? They come out looking a little bit skinny and a little bit immature. So they would get screened. Small for gestational age. So that would be babies who are like less than 10th percentile for weight. And so in a full term baby, that would be like 6 pounds, 9 ounces if you're a boy, or 6 pounds, 3 ounces if you're a girl. Or any baby that kind of looks like they should be, like they look wasted, right? Like they don't look like they have the bulk. But for the most part, we use the percentiles. And then large for gestational age, kind of, which is the other side, which are the big babies. So some definitions have the as more than the 90th percentile for their weight and looking large. Some people will say it's more than 4,000 grams, which is like 8 pounds, 13 ounces. Some will say more than 4,500 grams, which is 9 pounds, 15 ounces. So, and then another really common one is infant of a diabetic mother. And, you know, upwards of 10 to 20% of women could be classified as having gestational diabetes in pregnancy, depending on which numbers you use. So even though it's targeted, it still does include quite a few babies.
And which is...
And then the stress thing. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, yeah. And which is why I wanted to do this show, because I see... this screening happen enough.
Yeah.
It's common enough that people need to know about it.
Yeah. And I think it's common enough that it becomes more common too. You know, it's a little bit one of those. And that could potentially result in over-treatment. And we'll talk about the treatments later. They're not, you know, they're pretty low risk, but they're not all of them. And then any kind of distress. So like if the baby was in distress during birth, or if the baby starts becoming in distress after birth, isn't breathing well. So any types of symptoms, and we already said the symptoms are nonspecific, right? So you could sneeze at a baby and, you know, they could potentially meet criteria to be screened. So, but we really need clinicians to be looking at the baby as opposed to knee-jerking towards this kind of testing.
And I really appreciated that in all the literature that I saw, that in the recommendations or the guidelines from the American Academy of Pediatrics, that it was, here are your guidelines, but first and foremost, what needs to be applied to this specific baby? Like, because we don't know the numbers, because there's no clear rules around this, just look at that baby, put it all in context, and do you need, mm-hmm. you know, does that baby need screening?
Mm-hmm. And you know, that can be really hard. I for 5 years, I worked in a rural hospital where, you know, looking at the baby meant driving in overnight, because they would have other people covering the hospital at night, but you were the attending. And I think I agree with you. It's really clear in the literature. It says you have to look at the baby, right? You have to do an assessment. Is the baby doing well? In which case, hey, maybe we should check these numbers and make sure they're correct, right? Or does the baby really not look well, and we need to go down the algorithm, as it were?
And I think, you know, we are so concerned about this, because if screening and the solution to level sugar levels didn't create other problems, then, you know, whatever, just do it.
Right.
But
right.
Because it is interventions and it can highly impact breastfeeding and breastfeeding outcomes and the establishment of a breastfeeding relationship, there's mm-hmm. a lot at stake in deciding yeah. whether to, you know, do something about this or not.
Mm-hmm. And not to mention what you said at the beginning, which is really that critical piece of parents being all of a sudden, you know, pushed to the sidelines as clinical decisions start happening quickly, because this is something that, you know, you want to address if it's happening quickly enough that the baby's in danger, but sometimes can be slowed down, right? So that most of the time, I'd say, can be slowed down so that people truly understand. Because as soon as you hit parental confidence, you're also, you're also affecting their relationship for the long term. We know that that affects breastfeeding outcomes as well, and bonding, right?
Yeah. And that it ties in perfectly with my next question, which is, how long does this risk exist? And is it an emergency or is it an urgency?
Yeah, I think those are great questions. So, most of the papers will say, between 24 and 48 hours. And after 48 hours, like those other systems that we talked about really should be sorting themselves out. Right. And we haven't talked a lot about insulin yet and those large for gestational age babies. But in those babies, we do feel like, the insulin, the hyperinsulinemia, high insulin levels work themselves out in the first 12 hours. That being said, the transient neonatal hypoglycemia probably should be over in the first 4 hours, right? And then the longer it lasts, the more concerned we are for other things. So this is the other kind of nebulous, uncomfortable bit, is that babies who aren't able to maintain their blood sugar as they're going forward could have a metabolic disorder. So, those screenings that we send to the state, the newborn heel stick, classically we called that the PKU because that was the only thing we tested for. Now we test for hundreds of inborn errors of metabolism. But one of the first signs of most of those is low blood sugar. So, so that, that doesn't tell you quite so much the urgency, but the point is if the blood sugar issue lasts longer than 48 hours, we're more worried. Most of the time, it doesn't. So I just wanted that to be clear to your listeners too. So not everybody with most people with low blood sugar, with babies with low blood sugar, do not need to worry about that.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and especially because, there is this underlying thing of nature that it could be completely normal that the levels go down and then they come up on their own. When referring to, we've done sort of a general situation, and you mentioned the four risk situations of late preterm, small for gestational age, large for gestational age, and infant of a diabetic mother. Is there anything, do you want to get deeper into those? And is there anything specific for one or another that we need to know about? Or can we just continue lumping them all together?
Sure. Well, I think that it is important to kind of separate out. You've got the babies where those three systems we talked about just aren't quite kicking in yet, but will, right? So the liver glycogen, the muscles, and the lipids, right? But then the large for gestational age babies and the infant of a diabetic mother also have some insulin stuff going on. And that's important to understand because it's potentially preventable. And as we talk about what things people can do to prevent it, it's kind of important to understand where it comes from. So for the infant of a diabetic mother, the large for gestational age, generally those babies are coming from an environment where sugars are high and they've learned in fetal life to manage those high blood sugars, such that their systems are kind of revved up to deal with extra glucose, right? And they might have high insulin, and that insulin could persist after birth when the placenta is no longer helping them out with a whole bunch of high blood sugar, and boom, their blood sugar goes down, right? We tend to stop checks, like stop those routine screening checks for those babies within 12 hours because those babies do equilibrate, right? Their pancreas will be like, oh, right, I'm not in a high insulin environment anymore. And there are these other things I can do to control my blood sugar and not make a whole bunch of glucose go out into the bloodstream. And so I'd say that's just a little bit different than those cases that we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to really showcase that we're looking all in all. The idea is we're looking at a metabolic adaptation and not so much of this one sugar level test one time.
Right. Yes. And so, unfortunately, I think parents do get kind of, they get stuck on that clock, right? Because as soon as you have a low blood sugar, everybody says, okay, I'm going to check again in 30 minutes, or I'm going to check again in an hour, and you have to feed every 2 hours now. And, you know, what's really happening physiologically is we're trying to make sure that this isn't severe and persistent low blood sugar, right, which would put you at higher risk for bad outcomes. And we're trying to, in the meantime, give the baby time to recover, right, which can take 12 to 24 hours, depending on what kind of baby you are.
Okay, so then we've talked about why. Before we get into the how this is done, let's take a break. But yeah, let's come back to the specifics. We'll be right back. Navigating the ups and downs and relationship changes of having a baby can be so freaking hard, but finding the energy and time to connect with a licensed therapist to receive the mental and emotional support you need can sometimes feel even harder. That's why I'm excited to tell you about BetterHelp, which is pretty much the world's largest e-counseling platform. Their goal is to make professional counseling accessible, affordable, and convenient so that you can get help anytime, anywhere. At BetterHelp.com, you'll find a short questionnaire so that they can access your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. And then you can start communicating with them in under 24 hours. And that was definitely my experience, as I was connected with a therapist, frankly, in less than an hour. And scheduling sessions via phone, video, or chat is super easy. It was such a relief not having to wait weeks to get in to see anyone. And if by some chance I didn't think the person they paired me with was a good match, their website says that they are committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. BetterHelp is not a crisis line, and it is not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. There is a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's counselor network, which may not be something that's locally available in many areas. And the service is available for clients worldwide, so you can log in to your account and send a message to your counselor anytime and from anywhere. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule weekly videos or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room for therapy again. BetterHelp is also more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. Visit betterhelp.com/birthful and join the over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. For Birthful listeners, get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/birthful. That's betterhelp.com/birthful. And we are back. Okay, so let's say you have a baby that meets any of those four characteristics, or has some indication that it probably is a good idea to check the blood sugar levels. Mm-hmm. How is it done? When is it done? What can parents expect?
That's awesome. Yeah, great question. So I think for the most part, it's going to be done by heel stick. So unless you have a baby who's admitted to the NICU and they're getting lines, right? They're putting lines in another way, generally through the umbilical cord. For most healthy termish babies or babies in a birth center, it's going to be done after the first feed, right? And so sometimes this gets kind of messy because somebody might get a blood sugar before the first feed, but that's not by protocol. So you would get a blood sugar after the first feed, because the whole point is that the baby should already be working on some of those calories from the colostrum. And in order to get that blood sugar level, if you're in a risk category, then the baby's heel should be warmed with a heat pack, and then the baby would get lanced with a heel stick. And so it's like a little cut in the heel, and they squeeze the heel. Generally, right after birth, it's not excruciatingly painful. The babies don't tend to cry a lot, although the further you get from birth and the more awake the babies are, it can be very troublesome. And parents who have to have the heel stick done for jaundice, let's say, for days after birth can testify to how hard it can be. There are a few important considerations. One is that the heel really should be warmed, because if the heel isn't warmed, it might not be super accurate. The other is that the bedside test, which is used by most people, isn't the most accurate, because it's a whole blood test, not a plasma test. And so depending on the baby's level of level of hematocrit, which would be like a test for either anemia or lots of red blood cells, the opposite effect, you could have an answer that's not quite accurate. So that's a bit of a problem as well. But you should get an answer pretty quickly.
Yeah, and I was surprised by how inaccurate it can be, because mm-hmm. it said 10 to 20, and what's the unit?
Milligrams per deciliter, yep.
Yeah, milligrams per deciliter, liter, I can't even say.
Yeah.
Okay, so they can be off by 10 and 20, but the sort of general thresholds that I found were, you know, for babies lower than 30. So
right.
if you're off by 20, is it 50 or is it 30? Like, or is it right. 40 or 20? That was kind of surprising to me.
Yeah, yeah. So I think this is where it becomes, like, if the baby's not symptomatic, then it becomes an urgency. Right. And so as a parent, you really could ask if it would make sense to send a plasma level. Unfortunately, a plasma level might require getting more blood out than you would with a regular heel stick. The other consideration is that generally the bedside tests will overestimate. And so if you're low, then generally, yeah, that makes sense to consider it a closer to true low than if you're high. Yeah, but it still adds another level of uncertainty in an already uncertain algorithm.
Mm-hmm. And so, okay, baby was tested within that, like after that first feed. So sometime mm-hmm. within that first hour, maybe, mm-hmm. depending on the mode of delivery, cesarean mm-hmm. probably later than that. Mm-hmm. Between the hour and two, what are we looking at, and if the reading is low?
Yeah. So it depends, again. If the baby's symptomatic, things happen a lot faster. And I think any parent will want them to happen a lot faster, because symptoms show that the brain is potentially reacting
right.
to the blood sugar. If we're asymptomatic, so no symptoms of low blood sugar, everything is going peachy keen, the level where it becomes more of an urgency emergency would be, generally we agree, around 25. And that would be the level at which people would say, hey, this is really low. I mean, most babies are between 40 and 60 within a couple hours after birth. So 25 is really on the low end of low. And so they would get glucose gel and potentially admitted to the NICU, most of the time admitted to the NICU to start IV glucose. And in that case, breastfeeding should continue, right? So it shouldn't be a knee jerk to formula. In that case, we'd be saying, look, you need to be admitted because one of those mechanisms that we were talking about is so off that the baby needs glucose support through it. In other words, it's not about breastfeeding in that case. Breastfeeding is likely to be part of the solution.
Right. And so how would one navigate that of breastfeeding if baby's been taken to the NICU to get IV glucose?
Yeah. So I think it depends on the institution. Many NICUs are going towards open visiting hours, even private rooms, but just being an advocate for you and your baby and saying, you know, I really want to breastfeed as soon as, you know, my OBs let me. I'd like to come and be with my baby, and I'd like you to take me there now. Thank you very much. And in the meantime, hand expressing or pumping to make sure that your body, you know, that parent's body who has now been separated from that infant has the chance to be empty, to get the stimulation, to answer that question that your body's asking hormonally, like, hey, are we doing this? Do you want to breastfeed? You want me to make milk? And you need to be saying every couple of hours, yeah, yeah, I really do. Many hospitals will then take that colostrum directly to the baby, even if they're not quite ready for you to visit. And that can be baby's first feed through a syringe or a swab.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's huge for people to hear, because it can be stressful if there's a situation of separation or if the birth was really long and parents are exhausted. Mm-hmm. But for long-term breastfeeding success, that time that you're separated from baby is like that first hour is crucial to have skin to skin and a baby at the breast. And if the baby's not there, it's important that you do something and not just go like, oh, I'm going to take a nap then.
Right. And depending on where you deliver, everybody around you might be saying, go ahead, take a nap. We got the baby. It's going to be fine. Right. And that might look really good after a birth. You know, so one of the other things that I suggest is if the birth isn't going as you expect, or even if you anticipate having a baby that might need to be separated for a little while, to have that birth partner, whoever it is, be responsible for that conversation. So if you don't have a doula with you, if you're not lucky enough to have Adriana at your bedside, to just make sure that the birth partner says, okay, you created life, right? My job is going to be to help us remember that we really wanted to hand express after birth, or we really wanted to use a pump after birth if we got separated. And that way it shares out the burden. And it doesn't mean that whoever birthed the baby has to. Like, they can still say, no, I don't feel good, but at least to be reminded, because the evidence is very strong that the first hour after birth is essential to establishing a milk supply.
Yeah. And I carry a spoon, like a wrapped in a plastic sealed spoon, in my doula bag.
Nice.
Just for those moments, because I find that hand expressing, you can, if you just try to get like pumps and tubes, there's the colostrum, those golden drops get lost in the tangle. Whereas you can just go straight to the spoon, straight to baby's mouth. And I've had situations where even birth partners have taken the colostrum in that spoon and walked it over to the NICU. And given it to baby.
Awesome.
Not people around weren't that too happy about it, but this dad was like, excuse me, I am doing this. It's my baby. which is good for him, right?
I'm going to feed the baby. That is so good for him. You know, the other thing is if you're in a hospital and you didn't bring your Adriana approved spoon, you can ask for a medicine cup. And those work very well, and people are a little bit calmer about them.
Yeah, I just like that the spoon's super shallow, because you're probably just going to get a couple, like, you know, the baby's stomach is only a little marble is the size that you need, so.
Right, yeah, and the medicine cup is 20 mls, so all of these things can contribute to a parent's confidence and self-efficacy.
Right, and the cup looks a lot bigger.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not making it, I can't fill that cup, where it's like a spoon.
Right.
You've got half a teaspoon, all is good.
It's perfect, right?
Yeah. And so we will link on the show notes to, you guys have a beautiful handout in your website for hand expressing. And I'll link also to the video from Dr. Morton from Stanford that shows how to do it. Because the rates remind me of the percent, if you have know them off the top of your head, I think it was something like 40 to 60% increase in breast milk production if you hand express during that first hour, something like that.
Yeah, it's pretty close. I remember it in mLs, like by the end of week one, you could make between 200 and 400 more mLs per day if you hand expressed in the first hour. And again, you know, if your baby is being separated from you, it's possible that you've had a really high risk birth. And if you wake up 2 hours later and express, do not be hard on yourself for it. You just be excited that you remember as soon as you can. And the other thing to think about too is whether, when you have that conversation with your birth partner, do you want them hand expressing for you if for some reason you have a complication and you end up going, you know, being asleep when you didn't expect to be? And I think the answer to that is whatever is going to be right for you and your birth partner.
Yeah.
Right. And what is going to feel right to you guys if this happens? We have had situations where we've helped express women who have ended up either asleep or in a coma and then have recovered, and you maintain their ability to produce milk for when they're able to then reunite with their baby.
And I've been in the situations where birth person is just too exhausted or can't. But they want to breastfeed, and they're like, no, you know, do it for me, or have the partner do it for me, or somebody just do it. just do it, get the milk, it's good. Reading the handout and looking at the video, you can practice it during pregnancy, so that if you're placed in that situation, you have an idea of how to do it.
Yeah, and you know, we've only talked so far about the babies who go to the NICU, but I can talk about prenatal hand expression right now too,
Yeah, go.
if you're interested. I'm not sure how we want to organize that,
Well,
but
let's put that on the shelf for a minute because
yeah.
I do want to get into, you mentioned glucose gel, you mentioned an IV, and a lot of the times instead of that, what I'm more familiar with is formula supplementation. So I want to tease that out and make sure people know their options and what to advocate for protecting their breastfeeding relationship.
Yeah, I think that's great because formula supplementation has really made its way off of a whole bunch of protocols. That doesn't mean it's not being done anymore. And so what I think we really need to remember is that you can have transient neonatal hypoglycemia just all by your lonesome, perfect baby. You just have a few other factors going on, and you have some hypoglycemia. And then you can have hypoglycemia because you're not feeding the way you need to be, right? And so, and in my opinion, formula should only be considered in that later stage, and I'll explain what I mean. So first of all, for the first stage, which are the babies who just can't quite get the liver and the muscle and the fat kind of working all together at the same time, or have a little bit of extra insulin being pumped out, those will be babies who end up between 26 and 40 or 26 and 44. So it's that middle range, and different algorithms will have different cutoffs. So you might see 25 to 40, you might see 26 to 44. And this is a little bit about the uncertainty that we have. But if you're in that range, what we do is, for the most part, if you're in a hospital that is using glucose gel, you can get glucose gel, which is glucose and a little bit of water and a little bit of glycerin, and it's squirted into the cheek of the baby before the baby goes to breast the next time. And the reason why is because one of the things that we see is that babies who get hypoglycemic get a little punky, they get a little sleepy, and the glucose both treats the low blood sugar, potentially preventing any long-term neurodevelopmental issues, but also wakes the baby up a little so they potentially feed better, right? So that they don't go down that spiral of, oh, now I'm sleepy, now I'm going to feed badly, and now I'm going to get worse and worse. And you can do that, and you check the blood sugar again 30 minutes after a feed, and you can do that up to 3 times. Just to remember, this is going to take time for the baby's liver to kick in, and the muscles to kick in, and the insulin to downregulate, right? And so generally, that's what the glucose gel is used for. In hospitals where they don't have the glucose gel yet, and I think it's quickly becoming standard of care, people will tend to move towards IV somewhere in the 30s range, IV glucose, which may again lead to separation and impact breastfeeding. Most people agree that more than 45 or more than 40 to 45, and you're just going to keep watching if you're in a high risk, or we just consider that like, okay, you're doing okay for right now. I feel like there was one other part to the question that I didn't quite answer.
Yeah, when do you go to supplementate to formula?
Oh yeah, the formula. The whole point of the question, which is, so what I find that happens is that people start confusing with more than one low blood sugar. They start confusing poor feeding with other causes of newborn hypoglycemia. And so they say, oh, well, it must be about how feeding is going. So use a bottle of formula and you'll get better. Which may actually be true, right? The blood sugar may recover more quickly. But of course, we know that the other thing the bottle of formula does is that it interrupts the establishment of breastfeeding, and it offers the baby an artificial nipple, which may interrupt breastfeeding. And then the baby will sleep through the next breastfeeding. And then the mom's colostrum production might slow down, and she might get less milk towards the end of the first week. So there's a lot of reasons that we don't do that. And so what really should happen is if the baby is hypoglycemic, if even if there's glucose gel around, even if there isn't, is breastfeeding has to be assessed, and it has to be assessed well, which means we need to look, we need to watch a latch, and we need to know how the latch is going, not just that the baby happens to be attached to the nipple, right? But you need somebody educated and looking at the curve of the cheek, looking at the sucks and swallows, looking at any dimpling and the lip flanging, right? We need to look at breastfeeding. And then we need to look at mother's milk production, right? If a mother is sitting in bed and has tubular breasts and a history of PCOS and her breasts had no change in pregnancy, right? Then it's more concerning. It might be a problem with low milk supply or low colostrum supply. In my experience, most of the time it's not. And when people start saying the word formula, if your parents, if the goal, you know, the goal is exclusive breastfeeding, then what needs to happen next is you feed the baby, and after feeding the baby at the breasts, hand express or pump, whatever you can. And don't feel bad, right, about what comes out, but just get your little spoon. And if you're able to get a few drops, great. Because, you know, anything will help in the case of a hypoglycemic baby. But more often than not, you're able to get out a few more mLs and convince people, like, look, this isn't about volume. I have a normal volume. The volume that the baby is supposed to get right now is 5, right? So, yeah. So I think formula is often used, but mostly because people are not assessing breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm. Is there any situation where indicators come together to make it more of a push for formula or no? For example, a mom with gestational diabetes who had a cesarean.
Mm-hmm.
So baby's been, you know, didn't get that skin to skin immediately, but probably an hour or two. If by the time they get to the recovery room and starts trying to initiate breastfeeding.
Yeah. So I'd say, it depends on how breastfeeding is going. If breastfeeding isn't going well because the baby is sleepy, then the mom could be hand expressing and trying to feed the colostrum that way. If breastfeeding isn't going well because there's a latch problem, then we should be looking at the tongue and seeing if we can help with the latch. And if it's mom side, then like in the case that I was talking about with the mammary hypoplasia or delayed lactogenesis 2, then if there's no milk production, that would be an indication for feeding the baby something else, right? Rule number one is feed the baby. If that can be expressed breast milk, great. I believe we should all live in a world in which donor milk is freely accessible, but we don't. And so formula is, you know, that's what it was created for, were instances where breast milk is not available.
Is there a situation, so you mentioned situations with the birthing person, is there a situation with the baby's sugar levels that would dictate formula instead of glucose or IV in that sort of situation scenario?
That's a great question. And I'm not a neonatologist, but my sense would be no, as long as they're adequately feeding. Right? Because if they're adequately feeding and hypoglycemic, it's not about, women don't make skim milk, right? You don't make skim colostrum. It's not about the feeding. As long as feeding's going well, I'd say it's not because there's no baby side indication.
Mm-hmm. It's more of keep watching it and try to, or go to IV glucose or glucose gel.
Right. And now on the other hand, for people who, you know, there are communities where people are not available to assess how breastfeeding is going. And so a baby side indication in that case would be dehydration, right? Because if a baby's dehydrated, by definition, they're not getting what they need.
Yeah. And I'm but talking more it, like within my, the, within those first couple of hours.
Yeah. I mean, in my dream world, all this would be assessed prenatally. And then in the postpartum period, we would know what we were expecting and we would make, you know, the right decisions. And I agree with you. I don't see a role for formula based on neonatal indications. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that brings in a whole slew of complications. It's like, you know, you've got the birth cascade of interventions. It's like the breastfeeding cascade of interventions. We should do a handout of that.
Yes. Like, here's all the different ways
that this can fall apart.
Right?
And why you
and
need to hand express.
Where can we build the dams?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Now, So, in turn, you mentioned preventative stuff that people can
Yeah.
do. What are those things? Like,
Well, and I think we go ahead.
sorry, like, say, because we mentioned four factors that would make it probably the chance that baby's going to get screened, because usually a healthy pregnancy with a healthy birth with a healthy baby, like, that doesn't need to be checked for sugar levels.
No,
But it's
right.
more on these situations of late preterm, small for gestational, large for gestational age, and infant of diabetic mom. Is there something they can do ahead of time, knowing that there's a higher chance of this situation happening?
Yeah, and nothing's been proven in like a randomized controlled trial, but we do know certain things increase the risk of having a baby who is large for gestational age, right? Or that it can be worse to be an infant of a diabetic mother if the blood sugar wasn't well controlled. So I'd say if people have gestational diabetes, doing as best as you can with control and doing as best as you can with weight gain so that the baby is continuously exposed as much as possible to a normal glucose level, right? So that they don't rev up. So eating as close to a healthy diet as you can get. And then the other would be prenatal hand expression. So there's one study that was done in women of who had diabetes in pregnancies, so gestational diabetes or type 1 or type 2. And they started hand expressing at 36 weeks postpartum. And the big question was, is this going to increase their risk of early labor? And it didn't. It also didn't decrease the risk of infants having formula or needing supplemental feeds while in the hospital, but it did provide the women with a shorter time until that second milk came in, and they were able to breastfeed more. And so most OBs will be okay with around at 36 weeks of pregnancy of starting to see if hand expression feels okay, because touching your breasts in pregnancy sometimes doesn't feel okay. But if it does feel okay, to start doing that once or twice a day. And one of the other things they found in the study is the more you do it, the more you make, which of course makes sense.
And would it also make sense to, if you're getting anything out, to save it and then bring it with you to the hospital?
Absolutely. Although hospitals can be very fussy about what it's brought in. And so I would say, if that's your goal, making sure that you bring it in something that the hospital is going to feel like it was safely stored and so forth. So Medela has some colostrum syringes. They're wicked expensive, but another type of capped syringe would work really well. And frozen and put in a Ziploc bag. The other thing is, when you hand it to the hospital, they might not know what to do with it. And so it's important to tell them to leave it frozen unless you need it, because I have also heard of people bringing in their prenatally expressed milk and then it gets thawed. And then many hospitals have policies because of their preterms that say you have to use it within 24 to 48 hours and it gets tossed, which is really sad.
So sad, yeah.
Oh,
So
yeah.
sad, because that a lot of work went into setting up that
Oh,
situation.
man.
Yeah.
Right.
Would it be a good idea to, as you do the hospital tour, talk to somebody, maybe even in the NICU, and say, hey, if I
Yeah.
were going to bring in my colostrum, how should I bring it? And maybe even get it in writing?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And like maybe a lactation consultant at the hospital could help advocate for you. The other thing you could do is, it gives them kind of a heads up that says, look, we're going to have people who are going to bring this in. What freezer will we use? What labeling will we use? Because of course it's your label that's going to go on it, but it's going to be for the baby, so they need to think through those things.
Oh, and I think labeling is also something that we should mention, because I think they're more apt to use it if each syringe has a date and time of when it was collected.
Yes. And for better or for worse, I think that's one of the things that the bedside nurse will think is really important. In addition to which, unfortunately, milk gets mixed up in hospitals, so name on EH makes sense too.
Right, yeah. Which, it should be, like you're saying, it should be enough for them to say, this is my milk. I have it here. Give it to my baby.
Yeah.
And don't throw it out because I am the parent and I'm telling you to. Right?
Right, because yeah, absolutely. But unfortunately, these things go through levels and levels. There are resources that if a provider, so if somebody listens to this and brings their colostrum and the hospital doesn't quite know what to do with it, there are places that the hospital can call for advice. Breastfeeding kind of consult lines like the Infant Risk Center run out of Texas Tech. We run the Lactation Study Center here, and all that information is on our website.
Great, thanks. Now let's get back to that thing on the we left on the shelf about hand expressing. What was
Yeah,
it? Yes.
it was hand expressing prenatally, which I feel like we did a pretty good job of covering. The only thing that we don't know about prenatal hand expression is if you are at high risk of delivering early, if it makes sense. Unfortunately, those would be the moms that you'd want to have extra colostrum around. But you know, the difference between a 25-weeker and a 26 and 27-weeker is huge. And so if a parent is at high risk for delivery early, we want them to bake the baby as long as they can.
Right.
So
And
I don't think the risk would be worth it in that case.
no, and you mentioned starting to hand express around 36 weeks, right?
Yep. And the longer, I mean, that's right. And so the longer a baby can gestate, even at 36 weeks, makes a big difference whether they're going to stay with you, whether they're going to come home with you, whether they're going to get jaundice afterward,
Yeah, and even pay attention,
all of
like, are you hand expressing and do contractions start? If they do, stop.
Yes, right. I know, right?
That's one way to like check within and with yourself. Is this gonna my body gonna react to this?
Right.
Very cool. Is there anything else that you wanted to make sure we mention that we haven't already?
So, what I'd really like to talk about to end up is, you know, this other part of the picture, which is if a baby is going to get supplemented, right, with formula or with maternal express breast milk, or with donor milk, is how the baby gets supplemented, right? Because I don't think we have clear enough data yet on, is it the artificial nipple? Is it how much flow through the artificial nipple? What part of it is making it harder for people to breastfeed afterwards? But this being said, you know, what we tend to find, particularly in those early days, is that probably not introducing an artificial nipple makes the most sense, and using things like the spoon or the cup, or finger feeding, syringe feeding, things like that probably make more sense in the near term, than putting a bottle. And the other thing about the bottle is the colostrum gets lost in it, right? Because it's so huge. And if a bottle of formula is used, those bottles are ginormous. They're 2 ounces each. And they're made like that for a reason, right? Because then you'll use more, right? We'll expand baby's stomach and you know, and then we sell more formula. So, and by we, of course, I mean the company.
And potentially increase obesity rates because those stomachs are
Right.
stretched and babies are eating more and continue to eat more.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, if formula supplementation is something that has to happen for a medical reason, you know, and you're an educated parent, you've listened to the podcast and so forth, I would actually pour out most of the formula. Say, how much are we going to use, right? Okay, we'll use 10 mLs or we'll use 15 mLs. That, you know, depending on the age of the baby, between 5 and 15 mLs is going to be physiologic. And so there's no need because of hypoglycemia to just swamp the babies with supplementation if breastfeeding isn't going well. So now if it's breast milk and you want to give it all, you know, that might be a conversation worth having. But in the first 2 days, you probably will have between 5 and 15 mLs per session, which is normal.
Right. And it goes back to no matter what you're giving them, whether it's express breast milk or formula, that it's still better to do some finger feeding, spoon, cup, whatever, SNS, whatever, and not necessarily put your breast milk in a bottle to give because that's a different set of problems that you're creating in terms of functioning of the tongue and jaw and how to breastfeed.
Right. And that, you know, there's a lot of long-term data that we're missing on this stuff, but you know, particularly if it's going to be short-term supplementation, I don't think we need to be afraid of bottles, but if it's going to be short-term supplementation, I would not recommend taking the risk.
Yeah, and it's about, I think that just putting, like you said, putting it in perspective of this is a moment that you are establishing breastfeeding. So doing, you know, what you do during those first few days is very different what you are able to do with different consequences when baby's a month old or, you know.
Exactly. Or even a week.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
Casey, if people wanted to reach out to you or had questions, can they do that and how can they do that?
yeah, absolutely. So we have the website, and that's probably the best way. So breastfeeding.urmc.edu. So it's a really kind of easy website to navigate. There's the clinic phone number on there, and my email address is affiliated with my bio as well. So I'm happy to answer questions. The other thing is the Lactation Study Center. So we run the Lactation Study Center. We answer questions from providers, but we also answer questions from just parents as well. And that's through Mother to Baby. So if you Google Mother to Baby, URMC, we have a phone number, we have an email address. And then the Lactation Study Center, we have an email address and a phone number as well. So we can also help advocate for people or get data to the right providers for people. How does that sound?
Yeah, lots of places to get in touch with you, and I will link them all in the show
Sweet.
notes. Yeah.
Oh, that would be awesome. This was really fun. I feel like we went way over.
No worries. Sometimes the conversation's just good. Not only was the conversation really good, but this is me, Adriana, interrupting the end of the episode to say we talked about a bunch of other stuff, and it was so much. We already went over time, so I had to make a harsh decision and split up that content and package it for the Birthful patrons as extra content from this episode. So if you want to hear more about Casey's views on pacifier use and also preventive measures that you can take during pregnancy in terms of evaluating your own breasts to make sure you get a heads up if there's any possible complications that are going to show up with breastfeeding in those early days, go to patreon.com/birthful to find out more. Now, we got so wrapped up in our conversation about when and how to give glucose or supplements that I totally forgot to ask about what happens when baby is tested and sugar levels are fine. I emailed Casey back to ask about this, and she said that for high-risk babies, they need three normals, so between 40 and 50, depending on the institution, three normal sugar levels, then testing is stopped. And that for babies without risk factors, if a glucose test is done and normal, then generally there isn't need for repeat testing unless ongoing concerns or new concerns. And also, she wanted me to re-emphasize that skin to skin helps with blood sugar. So babies should be there, skin to skin, on the parents, even though during those heel sticks, as it also helps with pain. All right, here's the actual end of the show. Thank you so very much for being on the show.
Oh my gosh, it was so much fun. Thank you for having me. I hope I get to come back sometime.
Yeah, let's do it. Mighty ones, find the in-depth show notes for this episode at birthful.com, where you can also learn more about me, the show, send me messages, and more. And if you want access to ad-free episodes and the extra content that I provide for each new episode, then come join us over at patreon.com/birthful to become an official Birthful supporter. Check it out at patreon.com/birthful. Now, if what you want to do is get ready for life with a newborn, then go to birthfulcourses.com and sign up for my Thrive with Your Newborn online postpartum preparation classes. This episode was produced by me and made possible by you, those amazing Birthful Patreon supporters, and the wonderful people at Vistaprint and BetterHelp. Go to vistaprint.com/birthful for 500 high-quality custom business cards starting at $9.99, and go to betterhelp.com/birthful to get 10% off your first month. The title song for this podcast is Vive Ace by Kevin MacLeod, and the sponsorship song is Air Hockey Saloon by Chris Zabriskie. Find them both at freemusicarchive.org. Also, the Birthful Podcast is part of the Parents on Demand Network, a network of podcasts focused on parents. Download the free Parents on Demand app on Apple and Android for easy on-the-go listening. Oh, and here's what Dr. Rosen Carroll had for breakfast.
I had bananas with cashew butter and coconut flakes. Yeah, and I think, and sunflower seeds.
I'm Adriana Losada. Please join me next week when I'll be talking to a mighty parent as they share their amazing story here at the Birthful Podcast. Thanks so very much for listening. This episode is copyright 2019 by Adriana Losada.